Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Fingal, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is with great pride and eager anticipation that I extend this first welcome to the 2012 festival season, Music at Menlo's 10th anniversary. This season, we explore the power of music from the listener's perspective. How does music affect us? How do we use it? What does it mean to us? Over the course of 8 concert programs surveying music's various powers, from the animation of dance and drama to the deepest nourishment of the soul, this season meditates on the simple and audacious question, what is music for? We've entitled the season Resonance to reflect the deep fundamental exploration of music that we look forward to taking with you this summer. Just as the sound of music depends on the resonance of physical objects, our experience of it as listeners is defined by the emotional resonance it inspires. Music resonates not only in our ears, but in our hearts and minds, and affects us in ways that are impossible to capture in words. It is this strange and marvelous dimension of music that we celebrate this season at Music at Menlo. As in previous seasons, this year's installment of Audio Notes brings you in-depth discussions of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Music at Menlo's Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and a few of this season's festival artists who will take you deep inside the music and prepare you for the rewarding musical experience that our audiences have come to expect over the last 10 years. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts.
Music, the most abstract of art forms, perhaps most intensely captures the imagination. Concert Program 3 explores music's ability to enrapture listeners through vivid depictions of places near and far, from Samuel Barber's love song to the cliffs of Dover, and Isaac Albéniz's Pion to the Iberian Peninsula, to Gustav Mahler's enchanting setting of a child's vision of heaven.
American composer Samuel Barber ranks among the most venerated American composers of the 20th century. His music is widely admired for its fervent lyricism and expressive immediacy. And throughout his lifetime and in the years since his death in 1981, he has consistently been among classical music's most frequently performed American composers. Barber's compositional language can be classified as neo-romantic for its audible debt to the music of the late 19th century. His Adagio for Strings, one of the most iconic works in the repertoire since it was broadcast with the radio announcement of Franklin Roosevelt's death, illustrates the essence of Barber's finest music, melodically concise, harmonically rich, and emotionally affecting. Barber composed Dover Beach in 1931. It's an early work, he was 21 at the time of its composition, and it was published as his Opus 3. The work is a setting for medium voice and string quartet of a text by the English poet Matthew Arnold. The poem begins by describing the shore at Dover, the town on the English Channel across from Calais, France. Matthew Arnold spent his honeymoon in Dover, and it's generally thought that he composed the poem during that time.
The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full, the moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand, glimmering and vast. Out in the tranquil bay, come to the window, sweet is the night air.
Thank you. Well, the first thing that strikes me about Dover Beach is Barber's sensibility, his capability of setting a scene for that poem, which is so bleak.
Baritone Kelly Markroff.
What struck me when I started learning it and working on it was how complete the aura and the environment is from the moment it starts. It feels entirely complete, entirely appropriate. There's a silence involved in the sound. There's an eeriness. And this tonal world that you enter, I've never encountered another leader or a chamber music piece that feels so whole right from the start. It's like you've entered this person's world, and there you are, and you have the smells and the sounds and the sights. All of it is there. It's almost as effective as the best movie soundtracks in completing the picture for us orally.
Only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen, you hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling. At their return, up the high strand, begin and cease, and then again begin, with tremulous cadence slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in.
The poem is really quite riveting in its quiet desperation. Matthew Arnold was writing this poem at a time when he was witnessing Britain moving into the Industrial Revolution. So being a firm believer in God and sort of a romantic in the sense of never wanting to lose that cultural feeling of God as the center of life, he was quite horrified, honestly, by what he saw happening, and he felt like the onset of the Industrial Revolution brought to Britain an ungodly, sort of mechanized society. So this poem is really sort of a quiet plea for help, or rant, if you will, against what's happening in his society at the time.
Only from the long line of spray, where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen.
Well, it's interesting because Barber really accurately reflects the sections of the poem. So you get this piece that at once is entirely holistic. You feel like it flows from beginning to end without any drastic changes or interruptions. But at the same time, as you look more closely, you very clearly see the musical shifts that reflect the poetic shifts and the change from stanza to stanza throughout the poem. It always maintains, to me, a sense of languid melancholy, and the outburst that happens, let's say, three-quarters of the way through the piece, this plea saying, oh love, let us be true to one another, because looking at the world around us, we can see that the world doesn't necessarily give us hope, and it doesn't necessarily give us solace. We need to be our own source of joy. It's a really remarkable contribution to the chamber music repertoire.
Chinese composer Chen Yi was born in 1953 in the city of Guangzhou. She's one of a generation of Chinese composers, along with Tan Dun, Bright Sheng, and her husband, Zhao Long, who grew up during the Cultural Revolution when the study of Western arts was prohibited. Chen was forced to pursue music largely in secret. Following the end of the Cultural Revolution, she went on to study composition at the Central Conservatory in Beijing when it reopened. She was the first woman to receive a master's degree in composition in China. Chen came to the United States in 1986 to study with the composers Chao Wen-Cheng and Mario Davidovsky at Columbia University. After completing her doctoral studies, Chen met with an impressive string of successes, including composer-in-residence and faculty appointments, and numerous prestigious awards. She currently serves as a professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Chen's music integrates Chinese and Western traditions. Its harmonic language draws from Chinese folk idioms, but Chen's compositional technique equally reflects her Western training. Chen composed The Romance of Shao and Qin, a short work for violin duo and string orchestra, in 1995. She prepared a version for violin and piano in 1998. The work is inspired by a traditional duo of Chinese instruments, the Shao and Qin of the title. The Kuqin is an ancient string instrument similar to a zither, and Shao is a vertical bamboo flute. Using Western instruments to evoke these traditional Chinese sounds, The Romance of Shao and Qin brings the listener into Chen Yi's dual musical world. Finnish composer Jean Sibelius is the most important composer to his native country's musical heritage. He lived from 1865 to 1957 and was instrumental in cultivating a Finnish musical identity in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. To this day, he's regarded as a national hero and Finland's foremost artistic voice. Sibelius's music, in various ways, is consciously evocative of the temperament of his homeland, whether drawing from Finnish folk legends, evoking nationalist sentiments, as in his most famous work, Finlandia, or otherwise in more abstract fashion. The links between his music, his environment, and his heritage are inescapable.
Well, I'm sure it affected the way he was writing, because it's like a typical of the Finnish characters or the Scandinavian people. You know, they're very quiet, and it takes them a long time, I think, to feel comfortable to maybe let their guard down and start being like open to you.
Escher Quartet violist Pierre Lapointe.
That's what I think from meeting a lot of Scandinavian people, and also my grandmother was from Norway. Usually people don't talk too much. Not like me, I have a tendency to talk. They like being silent and quiet. They're laconic in some way. They use it only the amount of words necessary. It's pretty much what Sibelius does too. He's only using the minimum means to create the maximum effect. And that's definitely what I can see in the quartet writing and also the symphonies that probably would come from the Scandinavian people, the way they conduct themselves.
Sibelius is regarded primarily as one of the 20th century's greatest orchestral composers, but he produced a substantial output of chamber and solo instrumental music as well. The greatest of his chamber works is the Opus 56 string quartet, Voces Intime, Intimate Voices, composed in 1909.
Well, the character is very unique. It doesn't resemble any other string quartet that I've played before, even though it was written in 1909, if I recall. It's unique in the terms of character also, because if you compare with Mahler, because Mahler and Sibelius are very close to each other, I think, because they wrote a lot of symphonies and they're mostly known because of that. But that specific quartet by Sibelius, the way he does it, it's very unlike Mahler. Mahler is going to have huge contrast between like a theme that's going to be very like monumental and grandiose and then something very like quiet and intimate. With Sibelius, it's more a gradual ascension. It starts like very quiet, but nothing. It also goes with his musical language, with the motifs. Like every motif is logically exposed, and then he's going to manipulate some sort of variation, and then that evolves. Like it's like a cell like growing up in front of your eyes. The first movement starts, it's very mournful in some ways. Like you have the first violins that enunciate something, and then the cello will respond.
And then from that initial dialogue, you have some sort of crescendo, not only in dynamics, but also in the with the entrance of voices and also in terms of character.
The movement's primary thematic material derives from the sinuous opening dialogue between the violin and cello. The steadily intensifying first theme soon gives way to a sweeter, more lyrical musical idea. Not surprisingly for a composer of Sibelius' orchestral prowess, the quartet often maintains a symphonic breadth. Grand, double and triple stopped chords and dramatic rhythmic unisons signal important moments throughout each of the quartet's five movements. Another thing to listen for, in this first movement and throughout the work, is the audible logic to how Sibelius' musical ideas unfold. In the first movement, through the music's various changes in character, each gesture is essentially an extension of the quartet's opening measures. Notice, for example, the resemblance between that first exchange between the violin and cello. And this more assertive passage midway through the movement. The music eventually snakes its way back to the original violoncello dialogue, but now at a faster tempo, and with the inner voices, the second violin and viola, filling out the ensemble texture.
It's a gradual ascension towards the end of the first movement, which is very monumental. You have like double stops playing among the four quartet members, and it sounds really big. But then he changes the scene right away because the second movement is actually attacca. And then you have a fast movement, vivace. It's very short. It's maybe like 2 minutes. But there's a lot of things going on. It's very charming. But it's in huge contrast with what I come right before in the first movement.
The quartet's emotional centerpiece is the Adagio third movement. In 1909, during his work on the quartet, Sibelius suspected that he had throat cancer and was filled with dread at the thought of leaving his wife and children poor. Though the tumor turned out to be benign and was successfully removed, the third movement's emotional gravitas nevertheless seems to reflect the composer's melancholy during this time. Early in the movement, a languorous passage is interrupted by three mysterious E minor chords, whispered by the full ensemble in rhythmic unison. Over this passage, in a copy of the score, Sibelius penciled in the words voces intime, hence the nickname of the quartet. The meaning of Sibelius' enigmatic marking is not known.
And then the essence of the piece, the central movement, is the third movement, which is the adagio, because you have a lot of moments in the middle of that movement where it's very quiet, and the four instruments are in dialogue with each other, and they have to play motifs like very quietly, but again, it evolves towards something a little bit bigger, like in the first movement. The fourth movement starts, the rhythm is like in three. Again, the first violin starts, but there's a funny process of, again, cell evolving and growing up.
The movement has a folk dance quality to it, but carries forth with a stern demeanor. Even with the emergence of a contrasting musical idea, marked by fluttering triplet figures that might suggest a kind of levity, any sense of optimism is quickly snuffed out by an overriding sense of anxiousness.
That one is in some ways a preparation or setting up the stage for the dance, the gypsy dance and the fifth movement. The fifth movement, I really do think, it's just amazing. It's almost like Sibelius setting up the stage the entire time. Like, he's never really going full forces. You think he's gonna go there, but he's at the last second, he's making a detour. But on the fifth movement, he just goes to the end. And that's probably the most interesting thing in that whole quartet. Like, the fact that the audience has to wait and they don't know what's gonna happen. And finally, they get that moment. And then there's a lot of joy and feverish things going on in that last movement. It's very enthralling, and I'm sure the audience will get that.
Indeed, the concluding Allegro movement provides Voces Intime with a remarkable ending. Its triumphant outlook is made all the more compelling following the starkness and severity of the preceding four movements. Midway through the movement, a dramatic crescendo launches the music into a restless frenzy, with the violins and viola playing spiccato, a technique of using short, off-the-string bow strokes. This propels the music to a dramatic climax, full of willful defiance. Thank you.
that quartet, what is very striking to me, it's almost like a series of failed attempts to reach the ultimate folk or gypsy dance that you find in the fifth movement.
The dance arrives at a final statement, which Sibelius marks risoluto, and the quartet barrels forward, unbowed, to its thrilling final cadence. Spanish composer Isaac Albéniz lived from 1860 to 1909. Alongside the composers Enrique Granados, Manuel de Falla, and Joaquín Turina, Albéniz was one of Spain's preeminent musical voices at the turn of the 20th century. These composers cultivated an unmistakably Spanish flavor in their music by drawing from flamenco and other folk styles and integrating them within a Western classical framework. During his lifetime, Albéniz was equally renowned as a composer and as a piano virtuoso. Today, he remains primarily known for his large catalog of piano music. His piano pieces skillfully combine elements of Spanish folk music with a romantic virtuosity reminiscent of Liszt and Chopin. Albéniz's best-known work is the epic piano cycle Iberia, a 90-minute, four-volume paean to Spanish culture, and a landmark of the solo piano literature tackled by precious few pianists. This summer's third concert program will feature the opening miniature from Iberia, Evocación, performed by pianist Jeffrey Kahane. This summer, Jeffrey Kahane also performs a selection from Goyescas by Enrique Granados. Granados lived from 1867 to 1916. Alongside his contemporaries Albéniz and Manuel de Falla, Granados ranks among Spain's greatest composers, and his piano suite, Goyescas, is his best-known work. Composed in 1911, Goyescas is a collection of seven pieces inspired by paintings of Francisco Goya. Complementing the quintessentially Spanish flavor of Albéniz's Iberia and Granados's Goyescas on this summer's Transported program, Jeffrey Kahane and Wu Han offer the second part of French composer Claude Debussy's orchestral triptych Image, also titled Iberia. Debussy was the leading proponent of an early 20th century musical aesthetic that's become known as Impressionism, a term borrowed from the visual arts, and specifically the work of the painter Claude Monet. As a musical term, Impressionism refers to the rich palette of harmonic colors and instrumental timbres that characterize Debussy's music, and which we now think of as a specifically French sound. Impressionist music often approaches harmony and texture in ways contrary to the dictates of classical tradition. Debussy once said, quote, "Generally speaking, I feel more and more that music, by its very essence, is not something that can flow inside a rigorous traditional form. It consists of colors and rhythmicized time." End quote. Though he's recognized as the leading French composer of his and arguably any generation, Debussy's interest in the music of other cultures is also well known. He absorbed a broad spectrum of musical styles, from Spanish folk music to American jazz and Indonesian gamelan, and incorporated elements of these into his own music. This summer, Jeffrey and Wuhan will perform a four-hand piano transcription of Iberia, prepared by the French composer André Caplet. Debussy's Iberia offers an interesting foil to Isaac Albéniz's seminal cycle of the same name. Debussy's meditation on the Iberian Peninsula comprises three movements. The first movement, In the Streets and Byways, paints a bright and cheerful picture of Debussy's view of Spain. The second movement, Fragrances of the Night, turns mysterious and atmospheric. Its evocative harmonies are largely centered around the whole tone scale. Creating an exotic sound world characteristic of Debussy's impressionist language. The music slowly reawakens from Fragrances of the Night to the spirited The Morning of the Festival Day. One of the mightiest musical voices of the late Romantic period is that of the Austrian composer and conductor Gustav Mahler. Mahler's epic cycle of 9 symphonies, plus a 10th left unfinished at his death, stand among the most powerful and intensely personal statements in the Western canon. In addition to his symphonies, Mahler left a significant catalog of vocal pieces, many with orchestra, which likewise rank among the definitive works of the turn of the 20th century. With each of his colossal symphonies and song cycles, Mahler created a vast musical world into which he poured heartrending expressions of profound joy and sorrow, love and fear, wonder and anxiety at the world around him, and deep reflections on the human condition, in turns fatalistic and sublime. Mahler's Fourth Symphony, completed in 1900, presents something of an anomaly among the composer's other symphonies. especially in contrast to the unrelenting Second Symphony and the sprawling Third, whose massive opening movement alone outlasts any of Mozart's symphonies in their entirety. Mahler's Fourth is limpid and compact. Its character, too, surprised listeners of Mahler's time. Having stunned audiences with the expressive enormity of his first three symphonies, Mahler now turned to an almost childlike naivete with the Fourth. While work on the symphony proper took place between 1899 and 1900, the Fourth Symphony took for its finale a song actually composed in 1892, Das himmlische Leben, or The Heavenly Life. Motifs from this song run throughout the symphony's preceding three movements, thus prefacing the work's conclusive statement, a vision of heaven, with prefigurations of that vision. Mahler wrote of the Fourth Symphony,
"It contains the cheerfulness of a higher and, to us, an unfamiliar world that holds for us something eerie and horrifying. In the final movement, the heavenly life, although already belonging to this higher world, the child explains to us how everything is meant to be."
Mahler marks the tempo at the start of Das himmlische Leben, sehr behaglich, very comfortable. The text comes from Das Knabenwunderhorn, or The Youth's Magic Horn, a German collection of folk poems that preoccupied Mahler throughout much of his career.
"We enjoy heavenly pleasures and therefore avoid earthly ones. No worldly tumult is to be heard in heaven. All live in greatest peace."
The music turns more lively to reflect the next part of the text.
"We lead angelic lives, yet have a merry time of it besides. We dance and we spring, we skip and we sing. St. Peter in heaven looks on."
A lively interlude follows. As preface to the more turbulent second verse involving the lamb, a biblical metaphor for Jesus Christ, who must be sacrificed for the heavenly feast.
"John lets the lamb out, and Herod the butcher lies in wait for it. We lead a patient, an innocent, patient, dear little lamb to its death."
Johannes das Lämmlein aufs Lasset, der Metzger Herodes drauf maßet. Wir führen ein Gedächtnis und schon.
The comfortable music of the opening returns to accompany the third verse.
"Good greens of every sort grow in the heavenly vegetable patch. Good asparagus, string beans, and whatever we want. Whole dishfuls are set for us."
Spargelfisonen und
The music modulates down from G major to E major for the final verse. The richer sound of the lower key reflects the tenderness and contentment of the poem's close.
There is just no music on earth that can compare to ours. Cecilia and all her relations make excellent court musicians. The angelic voices gladden our senses, so that all awaken for joy.
Audio Notes is authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Wu Han, Patrick Castillo, and Isaac Thompson. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Samuel Barber's Dover Beach, performed by Gerald Finley and the Aronovitz Ensemble. Isaac Albanis's Iberia, performed by Marc-Andre Hamelin. And Enrique Granados's Goyescas, performed by Garrick Olson, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. Chen Yi's Romance of Xiao and Qin appears courtesy of the composer. Sibelius's string quartet, Voces Intime, performed by the Emerson String Quartet. Mahler's Das Himmlische Leben, performed by René Fleming and the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Claudio Abbado, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon, available online at www.deutschegrammophon.com. Debussy's Image, performed by the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sergei Baudo, appears courtesy of Superphone Records, online at www.superphone.com and available for download on iTunes. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.